It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Most of Wisconsin has seen at least some snow by this point. Temperatures have dropped below freezing, but that's just one way to notice the change of seasons. Got us thinking about the other things that really let us know that it's time for winter and holidays, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you mark the transition from fall to winter holiday seasons? Is there a yearly tradition that makes you and your family feel like it's time to leave autumn behind, embrace the winter? I know winter hasn't technically started yet, but there's snow. So maybe it's putting up decorations, a snowy outdoors activity, your local Christmas parade. Maybe it was hunting season or waiting for the lake to freeze up enough for ice fishing. What gets you officially in winter mode, in the holiday spirit mode? How early is too early for things like decorating or Christmas music? Are you in the mood as soon as Thanksgiving is over or still waiting to get on board with winter? Let us know your seasonal traditions for this time of year right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Me, kids were home over Thanksgiving. We did our annual tradition of decorating the tree the weekend after Thanksgiving. Managed to pull that off at least one more year. Do you have something like that? 800-642-1234 is the number to call or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Jennifer Dargan from the Educational Communications Board says the time-honored tradition of putting the lawnmower into the back of the shed and taking out the snowblower. And we put out the shovels on the front porch a little earlier than usual in the hopes that that makes the snow, you know, wait longer instead of waiting till the snow comes, then getting to the shovels without the shovels to dig them out. We did well on that this year. Related, Fred Schultz, human resources manager, says snow tires. Always put them on when the average daytime temps drop below 45. Fred's ahead of the game. Best investment to protect your safety in the winter, help avoid accidents. Usually, Fred says, I need to worry about not stopping too quickly and trying to avoid getting rear-ended once my tires are on and it snows. Couple examples of seasonal traditions that we can do this time of year. We want to hear yours right now. You can add to the conversation. What's on your mind? What kind of decorations do you have out? What kind of snowy activities are you waiting for enough snow to be on the ground for? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe you didn't notice. It was just Thanksgiving. There's snow. 800-642-1234 is the number. Again, we asked around here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Sherry Bouchel-Walter from our business sponsorship team let us know that for her family, it's about one image in particular.
When we feel that winter has officially arrived, our family has a tradition of hanging an original piece of art over our fireplace that depicts a group of children and puppies on the side of a snowy hill building a snowman as the evening moonlight rises above the horizon and shines upon them all. The special thing about this image is that it reminds me of a place where I stood and had a vision of my future family, even before we began planning for our family. This original painting was a gift to me from my husband, and he helps us hang it every year when we feel that winter has arrived. Looks like it'll be going up this week.
Great story. Thanks for that, Sherry. You can share your seasonal traditions for just after Thanksgiving at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you feel like there's holiday creep going on where things start too early? Let us know. 800-642-1234 is the number. Jeff is with us now in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Well, hello. Hello, Rod. I wanted to tell you that when it gets cold, I have a favorite pair of boots, and they've lasted me for years. But for me, what I do is I get a new pair of felt liners at Northwest Outlet in Superior, and boy, I'll tell you, they feel so soft and warm on the bottom sole of my boots that, you know, the boots can get old and ratty, but when you got new felt liners, your feet never get cold, and it feels great.
Now, Jeff, what is the signal for when you're like, yeah, I got to put on those felt liners? Is it X amount of snow or the temperature drops below whatever? What is the turning point for you?
For me, it's when actually I see snowflakes, when I see the flurries or something blowing around. then I know, you know, there's no turning back.
And what is the snow situation in Superior right now? Most of the states had at least a little.
Yeah, we have a dusting. I mean, you know, it's kind of the thing you can use a broom to sweep it off your porch or off your sidewalk. But
the amount you're going to ignore come March, right?
Yeah, it's like, you know, when you hit 60 and you get a little gray on the side, you know, it looks nice, a little white trim.
I got you. Jeff, thanks a lot for getting us started at 800-642-1234. You are our guest this half hour. We want to know what sort of things do you do to mark this change of season? Thanksgiving is over. December, winter on the way, snow on the ground. Maybe you're putting up holiday decorations now. Or maybe you've had them up for a month. I don't know. Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our own Colleen Leahy says, every year after Thanksgiving, my mom puts up the Bonhomme de Neige? It's a French thing. I don't know. Snowman, she says. For some reason, it's in French. Her mom got it at Costco like 5 years ago. Colleen says it's about 7 feet tall, and it lights up. And she is obsessed with it this year. The lights in its head and hat weren't lighting up, so it looked like it was decapitated. Colleen's mom performed surgery on it, texted us all updates. The surgery, I'm happy to report, was successful. BDN's head is illuminated once again. How about you? Are you a big holiday display, a big Christmas display person? Do you have giant snowman or snowmen in your yard? Tell us about it at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You are our guest this half hour. We're hearing from you about what activities, what traditions mark the change from fall to winter holiday seasons. Is it putting up those decorations with your family, hearing those Christmas songs on the radio, cooking or baking something special, something else? Was it hunting season? Were you out? Did you even call in? I know we had a couple people calling from their various hunting grounds over the last week or so. Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll hear from more of you. Fingers crossed, coming up in just a minute here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with you. We want to know how you mark the transition from fall to the winter season. What traditions do you have to let you know, okay, it is time for winter? Activities maybe that get you in the holiday spirit for the first time. Maybe it's a food, or maybe you're still waiting for enough snow or ice to do the stuff you love in the winter. Tell us all about it. Call in right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls. Clyde is with us in Fond du Lac. Clyde, hi.
Hi. Yes, in addition to all of the normal family things, decoration and get-togethers, I always look forward to snow to fly my radio control airplanes. I belong to the Fond du Lac Aero Modelers, and a group of us will go out there during the winter and fly off the snow. It's a great time.
Oh, so you use the snow as your launch and landing pad?
Yes. Yes, sir.
And does that make it easier for the planes, or what's the benefit of the snow? I've never done this myself.
Well, normally you would have wheels on the bottom of the airplane, and the planes that we fly off the snow do not have wheels. They're just flat bottoms, and they skid along just like a sleigh.
Now, I got to ask, is there a point where it's just too cold for these remote-controlled planes to function in the Wisconsin winter?
Well, we've been very fortunate in that regard, in that most of the planes now are battery-operated.
The oil doesn't freeze up in those.
That's correct. You bet. It does get cold, but we have a heated clubhouse, so we can go out and fly for a few minutes and run back in and get warm for the next flight.
That's fantastic, Clyde. I love it. Thank you so much for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Taking your start of winter, post-fall activities, your traditions for this time of year, you can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Karen is with us now in Middleton. Karen, hi.
Hi.
What's your what are you doing this time of year?
Yeah. So when I know it's winter or cold out, I know my cats want their heated beds out. So I pull them out of the closet, 3 heated beds and plug them in for them.
Right. Oh, wait, are these outdoor cats and they want that heat, or are these like kind of spoiled indoor cats and they're getting the heated bed?
They are totally spoiled indoor cats.
That's, yeah. And so do they just like, are they on those heated cat beds for hours at a time then?
Yes. I would say when they're not playing, they're on their heated cat beds.
Okay. And is there a stretch where it's starting to get cold and you haven't put them out, Karen, where they get a little extra whiny? Like, hey, where's the beds?
Yeah, I can kind of tell the way they're cuddling up with each other or go under the covers. It's time.
They don't take it out on you, though. That's good. That's very nice of them.
No. They're sweethearts.
All right, Karen, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Thanksgiving is over. Snow is on the ground. December is on the way. The holiday season is on the way. We're asking you to share the signs for you, the signals, the traditions, the activities that you do this time of year to mark that change. Still time for your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from a rural mail carrier. I didn't leave a name. But they said the sign for her is when her snowbirds, the snowbirds on her route leave, so they head south for the winter, she has to get the shovel out to deliver the mail. Oh, you're supposed to take care of that, I think. Even if you move out of the house or cabin or what have you, you're supposed to get your snow shoveled, not leave it to the mail carrier. Huh. Well, more power to you. Thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Our own Dean Canetter says this time of year it's changing uses for turkey. Growing up, the day after Thanksgiving, my grandma would make turkey noodle soup with the leftover turkey from the day before. We'd have lunch there after the local Christmas parade on the day after Thanksgiving. And Dean also says a newer tradition is becoming the record wall at my place. We pick out 8 vinyl album covers with a seasonal look or feel. The spooky records are still up from Halloween, I guess. Time to change to the winter vibe. How about you? How do you mark this transitional time of year? Did you watch parades and things like that? Did you do early Christmas celebration things right after Thanksgiving? Do you listen to radio stations that play Christmas music already now? Obviously, you're not doing it right now if you're hearing my voice, unless you have 2 radios going. You could join in with your stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our own Rochelle Wilson says, I take a classic approach of waiting for December holiday traditions until the day after Thanksgiving. For me, one of the big transitions has to do with dessert flavors. Fall and Thanksgiving is the time for pumpkin. But starting after Thanksgiving, it's time for peppermint. I love that there's so much great ice cream in Wisconsin. You always see Wisconsinites eating it, even in sub-zero temps. Actually, one of my traditions, I haven't done it the last couple of years, the coldest, windiest, snowiest day of winter, I'll get an ice cream cone or custard cone and eat it walking around outside. Just it's like, that's all you got, winter? I'm eating ice cream here. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. James is with us in Milwaukee. James, hi.
Hi there. One thing about this time of year, of course, is Christmas is coming on. Folks are rounding up all different kinds of candy, chocolate in particular. And that's my transition, if you will. I start looking for all kinds of chocolate. Chocolate bars, anything like that. I ordered, if I can find it online. And what I used to do, and sometimes still do, this started back when I was in college. I used to take down during the last month of the semester, December semester, the book Charlie and the Chocolate Factory by Roald Dahl. And that was always my thing. Going over to chocolate.
Excellent.
Loving now, chocolate.
I got to ask, James, what about the other 11 months of the year? Are you chocolate free until December, or you just eat less of it until December?
Oh, I'm not chocolate free. No, I just pick it up during December.
That's excellent, James. What, do you have a favorite chocolate bar? You can even name a name if you want.
My favorite of all?
Yeah.
Well, One of my favorites is Snickers, but there's a place down in Chicago that makes some of the finest candy bars I've ever happened on.
Wow.
And it's called World's Finest Chocolate, and you can get a box with five different kinds of chocolate bars, milk chocolate and crunch and dark chocolate and all that sort of thing. It's fantastic. It does cost, but it's very much worth it.
James, thanks a lot for sharing your love of chocolate. My transition things, I mentioned the, putting up the tree after Thanksgiving. I make soup. I start pretty early, but soup production gets into high gear. I've made like three soups already in the last week or so. There was a turkey and rice. I had a squash soup in there somewhere, and chicken noodle too. A lot of the basics. I'll be making many more soups over the next few months as well. You can keep sharing your traditions for this time of year, post-Thanksgiving, into the snow, into December, into the holiday season. Keep that going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, if you were ever going to Madison Co-ops from the late 1960s to around the 80s, you may have heard of the famous Gorilla Cookie, not like the animal, like Gorilla Warfare. The pastry had a cult-like following for about 20 years, but then suddenly disappeared from the shelves. And Ted O'Dell, the baker behind the recipe, took his secret to the grave. David Dennison, the senior editor at The Baffler, wrote about O'Dell. He chatted with WPR Morning Edition host Alex Crow.
Starting right off the bat, I know there are a lot of listeners who maybe hear Gorilla Cookie, and that's going to grab a certain part of their memory from Madison. For those of us like myself who weren't around at the time, can you describe what these cookies looked and tasted like?
It was a variation of what you would recognize as an oatmeal raisin cookie, but it was meant to be, it was described on the label, a whole meal cookie. And so besides rolled oats and raisins, it had a lot of other ingredients like wheat germ and nuts and probably a couple different kinds of flour, mostly sweetened with honey and I think a little bit of molasses. I remember that the label, which was handwritten by the baker, had the words chew slowly, but we don't have the full list of ingredients, so we're all guessing. I think that the interest in the Gorilla Cookie itself has a lot to do with partly connected to those times in Madison, Wisconsin in the 60s and 70s. But in some ways, you look for ways to bring back that lost time, and in this case, maybe with a lost recipe.
Can you go in a little bit about where the name Gorilla Cookie actually came from and those ties to the counterculture that really thrived in Madison?
That wasn't Ted's idea to call this wholemeal cookie a gorilla cookie. He developed it in the late 60s. By 1969, he got an agreement with the Mifflin Street Co-op in Madison to carry it on their shelves. He started delivering them, and someone, and if you remember what Madison was like in the 1960s, it's not hard to believe, someone at the Mifflin Street Co-op put a sign above the cookies calling them gorilla cookies. Gorilla in terms of warriors against the American Empire. And Ted was a fairly pacifistic person, so he didn't object to that name, and the name stuck.
Ted was someone who was very interesting to read about. What was it like working with Ted one-on-one, and what was that baking process like?
I had a brief period where I was his baker's assistant. He was very interested in education and history and the environment. We would be working in the bakery with Wisconsin Public Radio on, and he every day would listen to Chapter a Day as part of his continuing education. When the cookie was well known and popular, he circulated among a lot of the co-op people in and around Madison. He wanted support in turning his bakery into something grander, an educational center where he talked about educating children about nutrition. He wanted it to be a part of some sort of nutritional center that could do a greater good for the world than just producing a product. The proposal was met with no enthusiasm. By 2007, he was living out in the woods in a rustic cabin. Ted was a real nonconformist. Part of his stubbornness was that he became aware in the 2000s that there was a lot of interest in bringing back the cookie and trying to find the recipe, and why won't he share it with us? that he stubbornly refused because he felt like, why do I want to put this out into the world so someone else will come along and commercialize it? That's not what I was trying to do. So I think that's why this story caught on with readers. It starts out being about the cookie and it turns into a bit of a character study of Ted himself.
Do you think that eventually this recipe will end up being perfected, close to perfected? Because we don't know exactly what was in there.
He told me when I visited him, his cabin was out in near Broadhead, looking out over the Decatur Lake, which is fed by the Sugar River. And nearby was a golf course, but that golf course went out of business. And a group called the Three Waters Reserve came in and restored it as a nature reserve open to the public. And Ted helped to make that happen and donated his own land. I don't know anyone who is connected to the Three Waters Reserve, but unless someone went into that cabin and found the recipe, I don't know.
This is Central Time. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of the book, You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. And we've got some questions for you related to the topic. Have you ever made a decision, a turning point in your life, maybe based on something in pop culture, something you'd watched and seen on TV or movies? Have you ever gotten, say, a name for your kid from a pop culture inspiration? Did something you watched when you were younger inspire your course of study, maybe even get you interested in a particular career? When you watch scary movies, if you watch scary movies, how do they make you feel? Do you notice particular physical signs when you're scared at a scary TV show or movie? There's some science behind that. We're going to hear about it. We'd love to hear your story. You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, you may have heard the old saying, you are what you eat. The idea is that what you consume affects your life. The author of a new book says we should apply the same principle to media consumption, as in we are what we watch. We might think of movies and TV as entertainment that's fun at best, mind-numbing at worst. But our guest says data analysis can make the case that pop culture matters and has meaningful impacts on the world around us, from the way our eyes perceive images to the way countries gain soft power on the global stage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has a movie or TV show or maybe novel ever influenced a big decision in your life, like what kind of pet to adopt, what to study in school, what job to take, where to travel? Is there a piece of pop culture that's really stuck with you over the years? Have you ever changed your mind about something because of a fictional story you watched or read? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Walt Hickey is the senior editor for data at Business Insider and the creator of NumLock News, a daily stat-based newsletter. His new book is called You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. Walt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You start your book with your own origin story. You saw Jurassic Park at an early age. A lot of kids might watch that and think, I want to study dinosaurs, or maybe I want to get into genetics. It steered you, but not in those directions.
No, yeah. I watched that film, and you know, at the time, I was pretty decent at math, but, you know, the cultural presentation of people who were good at math were, you know, your Professor Franks on The Simpsons and just kind of lab coats and whatnot, crazy men with chalkboards in deep basements. And then you see this swashbuckling, lithe Ian Malcolm, played by Jeff Goldblum, come on, and He's the only guy who's right about Jurassic Park. He's the only one who can kind of predict that coming. And he just expresses his like contentions and his beliefs in just such a like fact-based and exciting manner that is just such a cool representation of what something can be, someone can be, if they kind of follow the stats and follow the numbers. And that got me back interested in maybe this is an actual profession and a career that I can study in college. So, and yeah.
That's just one small example of the main point in your book. We might think about, you know, TV and movie entertainment as entertainment. We passively watch it. It goes away. You make the case in the book. Tell us a little bit about it. Why should we take more seriously what we watch?
Yeah. So this book came about because I had been writing about pop culture for a few years, and there was just a recurring idea. I would talk to somebody who either made movies or worked in movies or, you know, was a researcher or a scientist or a doctor. And just kind of off the cuff, they would volunteer like, oh, yeah, you know, I used to watch a ton of Grey's Anatomy as a kid, or I used to read a lot of this stuff, and or I used to watch The X-Files all the time. And it showed them a different way of kind of seeing their world and potentially motivated them to pursue something that they might have not otherwise pursued. And so I was kind of propelled to just look into. I was wondering how pop culture affected people and how, you know, manifested in the real world. And I just found an ocean of information. I found, you know, it can come down to pets, right? After 101 Dalmatians comes out, all of a sudden Dalmatians become the eighth most popular dog in America overnight when it's re-released in the 90s. You can track name trends. You can track travel trends after The Lord of the Rings, which was shot in New Zealand, gets released around the world. All of a sudden, tourism from the Northern Hemisphere explodes, and you see a huge influx of people traveling halfway across the world to a country that they never would have traveled to before. You just see it time and time again in every different kind of field, from science to government to international relations to, you know, all sorts of different ways that people have been, you know, genuinely affected or genuinely moved in their beliefs, in how they see the world, in how they kind of perceive the world around them. And so that's what the book's about. It just kind of gets to the core of how these things affect us and how the time that we spend, you know, what we might think frivolously just watching things actually has a great deal of meaning and can make a big difference in our lives.
And you write, and I've definitely seen this out there a lot, when people do take a close look at how movies, TV, pop culture influences, it's bad, right? There's a lot of focus on this is influencing our behavior in a bad way, or it's making us lazy, or it's making us violent, or something like that. You dig a lot deeper than that. You find it's not always bad. Why not?
No, yeah, it's quite good. I mean, I think that there's this perception that, you know, when we talk about media consumption, we talk about, you know, television will watch your brain, won't rot your brain, won't somebody please think of the children? And that tends to be the framework in which we discuss media consumption. And it's wrong. It's not all bad. In fact, it's often pretty dang good. You can see time and time again that, like, you know, Roger Ebert, the famous film critic, had this belief in this quote that movies are empathy machines, that they give you a chance to kind of take a ride behind the eyes of someone else in the world and you know, develop an understanding perhaps of someone whose life experience you could never have or never maybe be exposed to given your current environment. And that is a kind of a humbling thing. It can make you have a lot more admiration for the people around you, from people who are different than you. And it can give you a better understanding just of how the world works. You know, time and again, like, you know, we can see all sorts of different positive impacts when it comes to, you know, people's interest and support for the sciences, right? How you can see people be motivated to do things that they might not have otherwise done. One of my favorite examples from very early in the book, one of the first studies I came across that kind of convinced me that this was a really cool thing to dive into was USA Archery. essentially had to run a study because they were so curious because they saw an influx in members, particularly young people, in the late 2000s and the early 2010s. And they were just like, well, what's happening here? Why are we seeing so many people take up archery as a sport? And so they commissioned a survey, and they found that a lot of these people, particularly a lot of the young women, were citing people like Katniss Everdeen and Princess Merida from Brave, even folks like Hawkeye from the Avengers, as this is the thing that got kids interested in doing a sport that, you know, traditionally maybe didn't have a ton of women doing it, or traditionally didn't appeal to the broad variety of folks who all of a sudden were compelled to join it. You've seen this affect all sorts of times. You know, one of the original studies that looked into this was the Scully effect from the 90s when the X-Files came out. The presence of Scully on that show, who's a woman who approached things with a great deal of science and you know, sought to solve these crimes and solve these issues from a very STEM perspective, motivated a lot of people to pursue STEM as a career, who were women who ordinarily might not have been dissuaded from going there. So you can see movies just and television in particular, and books absolutely as well, really open up people to new potential experiences, and oftentimes significantly for the better.
Talking to Walt Hickey, author of the new book, You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you've had an experience where a movie or a TV show affected something in your life in the short term, or maybe a decision you made down the road. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Walt, something I found really fascinating is people have studied physiological changes while we're watching movies. And one example that really stood out, yeah, are blood when we're watching a scary movie. What is going on?
Yeah, I love this study. You know, one of the ideas in the book is that this stuff has an effect on you. And if we want to make that contention, I wanted to argue, like, these are not just things that you're seeing. They're things that you're feeling and that your body is reacting to in a manner that your body would react to any other kind of stimulus, right? And so there's all sorts of different ways that we can measure that your nervous system takes films seriously, that when you watch these things, you're not just going on a visual journey. You're not just seeing a spectacle. Your body is actually taking it very seriously. And you as a person are internalizing the things that you're seeing and experiencing. And so one of my favorite studies that really just so illustrates this point is there's this group of researchers. They're actually medical researchers. They study thrombosis. And thrombosis is essentially clotting. It is it's the medical term for, you know, when people suffer a stroke, when they have coagulation where they necessarily shouldn't. That's called thrombosis. In the other direction, you have folks who suffer from hemophilia, which is where they can't, you know, form a scab. And so if an injury could be a very serious matter for them. And all of these come down to the clotting system. And so these researchers who work in the Netherlands are very interested in essentially understanding the human system that oversees clotting. It's one of our most ancient systems. The moment that animals developed blood vessels, we had to start developing the ability to patch those up. So it's a very cool thing. It's a very deep thing. It's a very ancient thing. And to that effect, they were one time, on a little bit of a winter break, and they were, you know, chatting amongst themselves. And because this is Europe, they tend to be polyglot and they speak a lot of languages. And so all these postdocs were talking about the fact that there's a word for blood curdling in all of their languages. They have it in German, they have it in French, they have it in Latin, English. Blood curdling just keeps on coming up. And so being the blood researchers that they are, they were like, well, we ought to look into that, don't you think? And so they essentially, they ran a study where they showed people different kinds of movies. Some of them were, you know, calm, low-key, champagne-themed documentaries, just a nice little hour and a half to spend watching how grapes grow. And then the other one was a jump scare full horror movie. And they basically measured the participants' blood before and after each of these. And being the researchers that they are, they discerned that when you see a horror movie, your body releases a chemical that's called a coagulation factor that is essentially one of the first steps that your body takes when it thinks that it's going to bleed. When your body's preparing itself for a potential injury, or when, you know, it believes that an injury is forthcoming or possible, or just, you know, wants to prime itself for the need to essentially stop a wound. This is one of the chemicals that is released in higher amounts. And so that conclusion is really exciting because it means that a horror movie is not just a thing that you see, and it's not just a thing that you, you know, watch very passively. It's a thing that your brain takes very seriously, that your brain is preparing for the potential that the things that are scary and frightening on screen could very well injure you, your human body. And even if you know that it's a movie, you're still taking it so seriously that you're having a physical manifestation of that anxiety and of that fear. And I just think that's the coolest thing. I think that it shows that movies are very cool technology that aren't just visual, aren't just audio. They're a piece of tech that can effectively allow our bodies to feel the same things across different people, across different eras, across different areas, you know?
Talking to Walt Hickey, data journalist at Business Insider, looking at his new book, You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. In the book, he explains how pop culture has a measurable effect on us individually and collectively, from biology, as we just heard, and personal beliefs, to economics and geopolitics. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been totally immersed in a movie or TV episode, found you were holding your breath, leaning forward, getting goosebumps? Did you feel that blood curdling that we were just talking about? Or has a piece of pop culture ever made you more hopeful, more cynical, changed your outlook on the world in another way, maybe gave you that baby name you'd been looking for? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with data journalist and author Walt Hickey. His new book is You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. It makes the case that pop culture has a lot more power than we may think to shape our lives and our society. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. What kind of influence has pop culture had in your own life? Maybe in a choice of a career, choice of a name for a kid. How do you feel when you watch that intense movie or TV show? Do you feel that biology we were talking about a couple minutes ago? Join in at 800-642-1234. Here's a movie, a 1978's Animal House, a scene that helped change the way people behaved on college campuses. Here's a listen.
You guys up for a toga party?
Toga! Toga!
I think they like the idea, Hoof.
Oh, Otter, please don't do this.
We got news for you, pal. They're gonna nail us no matter what we do.
So we might as well have a good time.
Toga, 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 toga,
toga. So in 1977, it sounds like, Walt, people at fraternities were not having toga parties. Can you talk a little bit about that story of life or art imitating life, imitating art?
Yeah, it's actually a really cool moment in the history of not just, you know, pop culture, but also, you know, higher education, right? So from the mid-60s to the mid-70s, the number of college students who were the first in their family to go to college hit a very high level. I believe it was just south of 10 million. And it essentially changed a lot of the culture because, you know, you had people who perhaps had parents or a father who went to college, but then, you know, you had a very large percentage of people who, you know, outnumbering those people who understood how college, you know, ordinarily worked, and just kind of came at it as a new experience and didn't really have a ton of expectations. So when the film Animal House comes out, it's a hit, it's a massive hit, and it helps people define what they want out of a unique college experience. It's based on, you know, the early college experience of a lot of the writers and performers within it. And so, you know, toga parties had existed as a, you know, a post-war fun thing. It's you know, a silly little, you know, thing that someone might do at a university or something. But after it's featured in this film as, oh, you got to have a toga party, then all of a sudden this shoots up. We were able to kind of track this over time based on, you know, Google's got this system called Ngrams that essentially tracks the usage of words within the English language over time. And we can literally track the increase in the prevalence of toga parties, starting with the release of Animal House. And then in particular, the cool thing about that is that it is kind of this generational thing where the first generation that grew up watching Animal House, they all had toga parties. And then when their kids start going to school in the late 2000s, 2010s, all of a sudden they're like, oh yeah, no, you got to go have a toga party. So you can just kind of see how a pop culture phenomenon was able to insert a tradition essentially into the American higher educational experience and just kind of, you know, find a group of people who, you know, didn't have that vocabulary of what college ought to be, and then essentially provide that for them and to really great effect, to the point that, you know, a lot of bed sheets have been ruined as a result of these events over the course of the past couple decades.
We got an email from Maya who said they named their son Steel after a character in the Dragonlance books. Their daughter's middle name is Ariel after the Little Mermaid. Their truck was named Lucille after The Walking Dead. You chart the influence of pop culture on what we name our kids. It can be big, Walt.
I do. And Ariel comes up. Ariel became extremely popular in the ensuing 10 years after the film The Little Mermaid was released. You know, it's just such a cool, like, instant reverberation, because you can see a television or a show or a book or often a movie really just means something so much to someone that they want to name their kid after a hero or heroine from within it. You know, Ariel was a really big one. Another recent one that we had was Arya. Game of Thrones really put Arya on the map. It was really not a name before George R.R. Martin came up with it. Even the Aryas before then were mostly Aryas, probably named after the book and not just kind of floating around in the general world. But you can see a whole bunch of names. One of my favorite ones, again, we recently lost Matthew Perry, but Chandler became a rather popular name after the premiere of Friends in 1994. You saw a similar effect with Emma, which is essentially the daughter of Ross and Rachel, and who was revealed during that, I believe, Super Bowl episode. Names like Luna from the Harry Potter franchise have really just begun trucking and have reached really high levels over the course of it. And so it's just kind of nice, because again, like, you know, it's really something to make a piece of work that resonates with someone, but it's something else to make something that resonates so substantially that it will, like, you know, somebody's grandma is going to be named Ariel one day. And we are living in that world.
Talking to Walt Hickey about his new book, You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. Now, here's one I found interesting, and I've definitely encountered it in interviews on this show. How we perceive crime in our world, and how it may be driven more by what we see in pop culture than, you know, what's actually happening with crime statistics. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, certainly. So Gallup is a pollster. I think many people are probably familiar with them. They're really cool because they've existed for a very long time. They were one of the kind of key innovators in the science of polling. And as a result, they have data going back decades. This is really cool for our purposes because they've been running a survey for the past several decades, essentially asking Americans, do you think that crime in your neighborhood is up or down or about the same as it was last year? And what we find is just consistently, year after year, Americans always think that crime is up. They always, by a significant majority, every single year, Americans think that in their neighborhood, crime is up. We know based on crime statistics, crime is not always up. You know, since the late 80s in particular, due to any number of combination of public health gains, any number of changes in policing styles, we can quibble about where exactly it came from. But nevertheless, the reality is crime's down by a lot. And crime went down pretty much year over year for most of the past 40 years. And so as a result, the perception every year that crime is up is usually wrong. Now, don't get me wrong. There are years in which crime goes up. That is absolutely the case. There's been, I think, if I have to recall it off the top of my head, 4 or 5 years over the past 40 where crime has gone up year over year since we started logging these very significant declines. But as a result, you know, there's still going to be a 6 o'clock news every night, and they're going to have to fill 30 minutes. And some of those minutes are going to be crime every night. It's the kind of thing where you can consistently see, you know, if you see shows like Law and Order in New York, I happen to live in New York City. And if you were to watch Law and Order or Law and Order SVU, you know, you would have a very significant idea about the amount of crime that takes place in New York City. It's remaining rather stagnant, enough to fill 23 episodes every year for the past 20 years. But in reality, you know, that's not the case in the slightest. And so we have this kind of perception that perhaps as we get more and more of these, you know, these whodunit shows week after week, or after we watch the news every night with kind of the same block reserved for whatever the biggest crime of the day is, that there's just kind of this distinction between how people actually experience crime in our world with how we perceive crime to be. And so, you know, the statistics can be a little bit comforting on that front. But yeah, the polling is pretty unmistakable. The crime's gone up every year, according to the polls, even if it hasn't necessarily done that in the actual stats.
Just a half a minute left or so. Walt, has doing this project and all this data changed the way you watch TV and movies?
And it totally has in a couple of ways. And I, like, this isn't a self-help book, but I do have some things that I've actually made me improve how I like media. One is that there's some really cool science in the book that I write about that basically argues that binge watching is not a good way to enjoy things. You know, but that they find that taking breaks in between watching shows, whether those are commercial breaks or breaks between shows, it actually enhances your overall enjoyment of a given show. And so whenever I've, you know, kicked back on a Saturday and watched 5 hours of television, now I actually alternate between shows to, just so that I can get a little break in there. And I've actually found that I'm enjoying things a little bit more. I don't know. I don't really come away with it saying that, you know, different kinds of media are good or bad, but I'm definitely aware of what I'm watching more, definitely trying to broaden my horizons a bit more. Cause I just, you know, it's always a good reminder that there's a really big world out there.
That's where we'll leave it. Thanks to our guest, Walt Hickey. We've been talking about his new book, You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. If you are a fan of motorsports, car racing in one form or another, today is a big milestone anniversary for you. The first recognized car race in the United States, though it didn't exactly go to plan. As reported at history.com, on this day in 1895, a big race was scheduled just south of the border in Illinois. The Chicago Times-Herald hosted the event. The plan, 92-mile race from Chicago to Waukegan and back. 89 racers signed up with a variety of makes and models. But hey, it's late November in the Midwest. A snowstorm came. Only 6 of those 89 made it to the starting line for a race shortened to 50 miles. Only 2 of those cars made it to the finish line. The winner, covering 50 miles in 10 hours, a Duryea motor wagon. That catapulted Duryea's gas-powered car to fame with sales of 13 motor wagons over the next year. Top-selling model of the year. Things have changed a bit since then. Start your engines. This is Central Time.